Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
My guest on this week's show has been performing comedy for close to 30 years, and yet somehow she is still best known for playing computer genius Chloe O'Brien.
When they come through the door, you tell them that you found me at the sniper rifle. I turned on you and you opened fire.
Don't ask me to do something I can't do.
Damn it, Chloe, pull the trigger. We are running out of time. They're going to find us soon. You said you would do exactly what I would say, that you would follow this through. Now pull the trigger!
I can't!
Yes, you can, and you will. Now pull the trigger!
No!
Damn you, Chloe, pull the trigger!
Jack!
We are running out of time. Pull the trigger!
Please don't make me do this.
Chloe, I know how hard this is for you, but if you care about me at all, you will pull the trigger. Do it!
Sorry, I can't.
Chloe, pull the trigger!
No, Jack!
Pull the trigger!
I'm not gonna do it!
Damn you!
This is The Last Lap. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and that was Mary Lynn Rice Cub in one of her many super intense scenes opposite Kiefer Sutherland on the long-running Fox drama 24. But as you will learn from this episode, Mary Lynn has always been a comedian at heart. From her early days in the alt comedy scene, to her sketch comedy work on Mr. Show, to her iconic role as Gail the Snail on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. She's also had bit parts in huge movies like Man on the Moon, Magnolia, Little Miss Sunshine, and so many others. And just this year, she popped up in one of my favorite shows, The Dropout, as the wife of William H. Macy's character. My point is, you almost certainly know Mary Lynn's face, even if you don't necessarily recognize her name, a conflict that she explores at length in her new memoir, Famish, My Life at the Edge of Stardom, which is officially on sale starting today. I began our conversation by asking her to read an excerpt from the book's introduction.
Things have really changed, I thought, as I drove my parents' Ford Explorer down Allen Road in Trenton, Michigan in 2014. My mother had a sweatshirt made that read, "I'm Chloe O'Brien's mom," in reference to the character I played on the wildly popular show 24. She wanted the world to know. I had been on Late Show with David Letterman and in GQ, had visited the White House, and people listed me as one of the world's most beautiful people. I had worked with tons of famous people and been in many TV shows and movies. I had made it. My tone in this is even better than the audiobook.
Oh, yeah.
The way that I'm reading this is with a little sarcasm. You're like, what's her problem? 15 years prior, when I first started acting on TV, I remember my sister telling the cashier at Kroger, "She's famous." I was mortified. The cashier stared at us like, "What the fuck are you talking about? Don't you recognize her?" "No." My sister put the cashier in her place. "She's on Veronica's Closet on NBC. This is a good book, you guys. I wanted to disappear into an automatic trapdoor in the floor. This isn't how I was supposed to feel. I should be like James Brown or Tom Jones. Diamonds on all my fingers, women throwing their underwear at me. "Hi, it's so nice for you to meet me," I'd bow in my cape and platform shoes and do a superstar shimmy. "Get up off of that thing. Watch out, pussycat," I'd say. Yeah, I wrote that down on a piece of paper. Instead, I looked down and said nothing. "If you don't know who she is, it's your loss." Then my sister Kathy cascaded out with an air of superiority as I mouthed, "I'm sorry," to the cashier.
So is that something, I mean, is this sort of a big part of your life now, is these strange fan interactions?
Yeah, but it kind of is the theme of this book. That's a backdrop, being recognized. And that's just sort of is my entry into the larger picture, because that I like that stuff. It's fun. But what's more interesting to me is living a completely quiet life punctuated by stuff like that. Or in the same way, experiencing, and I really do mean this, like, I'm lucky that I sort of had it and then didn't have it, or, you know, because I'm doing a ton of stand-up now. But it's like, I was on the most popular show that was on television at the time. So I got this very, you know, first-class treatment, because I entered into a show that was already hugely popular. And then, you know, cut to 10 years later when I'm like, I'm going to be a road comic. And I'm going just by myself to these clubs where it's a real mixture. Some people are fans, some people are not, and it's a very different experience than this being this very recognizable character. But there's a part about a guy who sees me flying coach and calls me by my character name and says, "Well, aren't you set for life?" And people can't imagine that there are different, layers to this experience, monetarily included.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because this book really does have an sort of unusual frankness about fame and money and, all of that. And as you said, you say something like 24 changed your life, but it didn't make you set for life.
Right.
And that's something that people, as you said, don't understand. Why was that something that you really wanted to write about and get out there? Was it to sort of, disabuse people of this idea that it was different than that?
I mean, I think at the end of the day, there is a spiritualist in me, money can't buy everything. And at the beginning of the day, the external part of that I use for humor is just not having it when you think you should have it, or not being somewhere where you think you should be. And I think that everyone can relate to an expectation of how you thought something was going to be, and then it's not that way. And then you find stuff out about yourself, which in my case is, oh, I like laundromats. Like, there's a part of me that, you are creating your way no matter what the circumstances, and that's okay. And maybe I, had a certain amount, but it wasn't set for life. But that's what life is about, is taking all these components and jumbling them up, because if I look at where I came from, it's incredible what I've accomplished.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I have to say, as a member of the press who's attended a lot of, strange Hollywood events, I really related to your story about going to the Golden Globes by yourself and how bizarre that could be.
The quintessential, I'm hoping that people read that and go, wait, I'm sorry, what? Did I read that right? Because it almost doesn't even make any sense. It's like you get invited to this thing that's fancy, that's exclusive, that's celebratory in nature, and to be only given one ticket is just such a disconnect. And that's, there is this hierarchy within these events like that, where it's exciting and it's glamorous, but then just beyond the facade, like the literal shot for television, it is not, it is, but it's not. Like, everyone's dressed up, everyone's excited. There's, the table was set beautifully, but then you'll turn around and there's a crush of people just trying to get to their cars, and like men pushing women in gowns, and, no one looking at you unless you are like the most famous category. It's an interesting all in one, what's the word I'm looking for? All pressed together, like that experience of going to an event like that and realizing how not cool it is.
Yeah. How it's not nearly as fun as it might seem from the outside, or how people watching at home think it would be.
Yeah. And it sounds cliche, but it's like being at a house party or hanging out with your friends on a dirty roof is much more, could be one more, or in an alley behind a club, or, but my thing is a lot of comedy shows, a lot of rooms that people started is like, some ways is much more comfortable and a much better time than going to a big fancy awards show.
Yeah. I mean, so there is this real tension in your career, as you said, between being on this huge drama show, 24, and that's where a lot of people know you from, but you really are a comedian, and you have been a comedian, for your whole career, and you're still performing stand up. So, what is that like for you to be, on the road, and maybe people are not always coming to your, don't always know what to expect coming to see you?
It's pretty wild, pretty wild. It's good for me as an artist and performer, because it gives me the chops to find out what is going to capture people's attention, and find out the attitude that I have to take in order to move the show forward for everyone in a setting that's incredibly immediate. There's no time to do another take. There's no time to relinquish control of the room, and the ability to be able to think on your feet is is exciting, and it, there's something, you know, it can be pretty nasty. It can be very humbling, but it's really strengthened me as a writer and a performer. And it's fun, you know. The other side of it is it's fun when you do connect with people who don't even know why they're there necessarily. You know, so you have people like that right next to somebody who's got their DVD that they've been holding on to for 12 years. So it's a really fun experience, a really fun cross-section of people.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways your comedy has become, you know, your stand-up has become more traditional in terms of telling stories about your life and everything. But can you describe what your act was like early on? Because it was pretty out there, I think, when you started.
What do you know?
There's a clip from the book, and then there's a clip that I found online on YouTube. And I don't know if it actually is, but it says it's your very first.
That's real.
Your very first open mic. Yeah. Where you're just kind of, I guess you would just, I could describe it as delivering a series of unrelated punchlines into the mic.
Next person up to the stage came here all the way from Provo, Utah.
Wow.
What she said, the first and only female comedian of tonight. Let's give it up for Mary Lynn Smith.
Doing. So the lion said to the lady, "Excuse me, but your hair's too long. And the Buffalo Shuffle has never been done like this before."
Can you talk about what you were thinking at that point and what you were doing when you first started doing comedy?
I can't believe you watched that clip. That's so funny. I was doing performance art, and then I started making fun of performance art, and I was so disconnected from my own self and my own convictions, my own thoughts, my own vision, you know, which in a way lends itself to acting. And it did, because you're latching on to other characters for that expression. But a huge component to me was solo performing. And at the time, I didn't call it stand up because I did not relate to stand ups, which I associated with being a dude in a suit who's very opinionated and very loud. And that was not my entry point into the world, let alone onto the stage. So this whole thing has been this, this process, which, you know, I am very lucky. I can look back at the stage in my life and say I was able to make a career out of my artistic process. And at that time, it was like I was imploding from not being able to express myself. I went to school for painting, but I was just like, I just had this need and this compulsion really to perform. But I did not really have my wits about me. But there was something about me that just compelled me to be improvisational, to, you know, just say whatever came into my mind. And whatever prep work I did was just this bizarre collection of, non sequiturs and punchlines without the premise. And I think that clip that you watched, I do write about that in the book, was from a period of time when I had this boyfriend who said he did comedy. Yeah. And like, creativity is a weird thing. And like, whatever ego and ambition and whatever ball of wax that was, because I remember watching him and going, I could do that. And going up at that open mic the next week. And that is what you saw. And that definitely was my first time on a stand-up stage. So you can imagine from that to moving to San Francisco, to trying all these different shows, to starting to do a character-ish, to realizing it was funny, not really knowing why, meeting a group of people, let's do shows in LA. But a friend of mine went on to become a big movie director, and he said to me, he saw me at the Improv years later, and he's like, yeah, you never had material. You just had a presence and a willingness. And I think that's what, looking back, lended itself to acting work, because I was really being vulnerable on stage, and the laughs came from, is she okay? That was a lot of my earlier performances are like, what's going to happen with her? And that's like the tension that I was building, which is, you know, is like making those connections to comedy, that tension is inherent in it. And I would say it's only now in the past few years that I've, you know, lived the life and grown up, and certainly 24 was a huge part of that, and all the other things that I experienced in my career of, and then, you know, life itself of now being able to formulate my point of view.
Well, you were probably fortunate in some ways to be coming up in the middle or at the beginning of this alt comedy thing that was happening.
Absolutely.
Right? Where people really were trying things in a different way. And who were some of those people who you were, you know, performing with at the time that were also
different. a beautiful, organic, such a creatively fertile time. And there was a certain magic to it in terms of how I ended up at that time in that place when I did, because everybody I was hanging out with, I mean, it was like David Cross, Bob Odenkirk, Jack Black, Karen Kilgariff, Kathy Griffin, Molly Shannon, Janine Garofalo, tons of people. We would all perform at the same shows. And I remember David Cross and the kind of people that came from the Boston comedy scene in the 80s or late 80s. You know, there was this attitude of, you know, F traditional comedy clubs. And it was this group of people that really together wanted to do something that wasn't what the mainstream boom had been. So it was, you know, like the swinging of the pendulum in the opposite direction and kind of breaking through this very successful period of stand-up comedy where we get all of our, you know, all the classic big guys that broke through in stand-up. And this was the whole movement that was, we don't want to do that, which I think now today has like really infiltrated and influenced comedy as we know it. Now there's
it's
like
sort
so
of become
many different,
mainstream in some ways.
Yes. But at the time it was really different. And that was the time I was in LA, and it was like, it was the best thing that could have ever happened to me, because I really felt like for the first time I was just giddy with, I'm around my people. I mean, I was out of my mind. And it was lucky for me that I went into acting, because I can remember, you know, other friends of mine were writing like sketch packets, and I was just like, what is that? I just had too much. I couldn't, had a lot of, social anxiety and a lot of, just an inability to, you know, have the mindset to be able to do any of that stuff. But
you did, you did become a founding original cast member of Mr. Show, which was a big part of that. So how did that happen? I mean, you mentioned that you met, you know, Bob Odenkirk and David Cross, you know, in clubs, but then you ended up, you know, as part of their show on HBO, which is, you know, to me sort of the best, most influential sketch comedy show of that era.
Absolutely. And, I like that you used the word founding. I'll take that, because I was there when it was when it was founded. I was in some of those early shows. And that was such a wonderful thing to be a part of. Some of those early shows where I remember, you know, executives from HBO are going to be in the audience, and we were at this storefront theater in Santa Monica. I think it was an improv theater that Bob had been affiliated with. And, you know, Bob and David had been working for quite a while, and they were doing these sketches live as part of the pitch for this show. And it was, things were leaning towards, it was all but sold, and they were doing these like sort of proof of concept live shows. But yeah, before that, it was all of us doing these themed shows. Jack Black and Kyle Gass like created Tenacious D there. Greg Barrett was there at the time. You know, he went on to become sort of famous for writing that book, and that turned into a movie. And there was a lot of people that were just doing different things and finding their voice. And my involvement in Mr. Show, I really feel like I was kind of a mascot that, you know, I was so green, and we all hung out together, and we all laughed a lot together and did a lot of shows together. And I think they just kind of took me along. And those were some of the first, I remember being so nervous for any little part I would have in a sketch. And then, you know, they gave me the job of introducing the shows. And, you know, I was a bit of a pet, I would say. But, you know, I like your term of founding member. I think
from the beginning.
Absolutely. It was like really exhilarating. It was just a joy to be around them and see that process, you know, and to imagine being me. I mean, I really do feel like dropped off the bus into this world of just the most brilliant people pushing boundaries and so smart and so funny.
Yeah. And I think you were there for the first two seasons. Is that right? Yeah. And so was there what prompted you to leave the show? And did you, were you sort of moving on to something else Or how did that work?
Yeah, I had started to work on Larry Sanders' show and I was getting parts in TV shows. I had also was dating David Cross and I broke up with him. So he, I think they decided that I was no longer funny to have around. And so I did not have that job anymore. So that would be the real scoop behind the scoop. But let's
that's,
just say
that's kind
that,
of unfortunate. But
let's just say I went in another direction.
One other Mr. Show.
It was a different time.
One other Mr. Show thing that I just feel like I have to ask about, because I think he comes up in your book. I just kind of have to know what happened to Jay Johnson?
You know, I hung out with him for years after Mr. Show. We stayed in touch and were sort of in the same social circle. And then I don't really know. I haven't kept in touch with him.
Yeah. I mean, for anyone listening who doesn't know, he was pretty famously caught on camera at the Capitol riot in 2021.
Yeah. I mean, I saw that insurrection picture and I saw the people that confirmed it was him online and the people that didn't say anything. And, but even that, I still have not heard what happened after that. And I don't know where he is. And I haven't,
I'm sort of surprised
that I haven't heard from anybody to follow up.
I feel like maybe there's some reluctance on the part of some of his, former friends and coworkers to really talk about it.
Like, I mean, like everybody loves him. Like I love him. I don't want anything bad to happen to him. Of course, I do not support storming the Capitol in any way. I think that's mentally, I question where you're at if you want to do something like that. But that's his choice. And I don't really know, in terms of people's reluctance to talk about it might be one thing, but just in terms of what actually happened and where he is, I don't have any of that information either, which is weird and kind of sucks. But
yeah, no, I mean, it was definitely surprising for me as someone who doesn't know him and had only, seen him on Mr. Show and on, he was on Sarah Silverman's show and
he's been recently
on Bob's Burgers and
brilliant and beloved. So I'm not sure what happened.
Well, you mentioned Larry Sanders' show and that was something where you kind of came in. Was it that you were replacing Janine Garofalo in a way on that show?
Yes, I was. I write about that in the book. It was one of my best, my favorite auditions ever, because I'd actually done a show of Janine was hosting this show called Comedy Product. It's a very 90s alt. She was hosting sort of like curating, people that were doing stand-up sets on this. That's what the show was, a half hour of her hosting other people's stand-up. And, this would be another one of those very early tapes of mine where the character was a performance artist. No, what it was I was doing my version of stand-up. And then my friend said to me, say you're a performance artist at the beginning and then people will understand what you're doing. Like, I really didn't even understand, oh, this is a character. Everything was just in my head at the same time. So in my mind, I was like, oh, this is my material. And then he said, say you're a performance artist and then you'll give people permission to laugh. Which is sort of like a basic thing that you need to know about comedy to make your audience comfortable. But I was coming at it from such a raw place that I didn't understand that. But anyway, so he showed that tape to Gary Shandling and his head writer, John Rigi, and they called me in for a meeting and it was the best because there was no material. We just kind of looked at each other. And that's what I write about in the book, is just the experience of like, I don't know, what are you doing? And we just kind of made each other laugh over nothing. And then they hired me from that. And that's my favorite, when people follow their instincts and they have such a strong vision that they know that you'll work for that vision rather than being so stringent to stick to the script. I mean, obviously there are many different ways to work, but I happen to really love that they were like, oh, we like that quality and we know how to work with this. It wasn't about like sticking to the book, delivering this monologue a certain way. It was more like, we like what you're about.
What do you feel like you learned about acting from Gary Shandling?
Gary Shandling gave me one of the biggest lessons because my start was, I was so raw and I was so instinctual And it was so organic that that's my way of saying, well, I didn't really have any formal training. So that's my way of saying I did not know what subtext was in acting. And so I would just perform. And I was doing a scene on the Larry Sanders Show, and he said, what are you thinking right now? And everything stopped. And I remember I feeling berated by him, but it was a true tough love moment, because he was calling me out on the fact that he could tell when he was doing a scene with me that I hadn't given any thought to what was really going on with my character. I was just saying the lines, and it was so terrifying, and I could have been fired, and it was so bad. But I also learned everything, most of what I needed to know about acting in that moment. And from that point on, my approach was different. So I've been very lucky to learn on the job like that, you know?
Coming up, more highlights from Mary Lynn's incredible career, including the surreal experiences of acting opposite Jim Carrey in character as Andy Kaufman, and her makeout scene with Tom Cruise that was cut out of Magnolia.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to my conversations with other Mr. Show alums like David Cross, Sarah Silverman, and Scott Aukerman, along with everything else from our free archive. And you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Mary Lynn Ricecup. Well, after, you know, Larry Sanders, I mean, and everything else, you've been in so many iconic movies and roles over the years, you know, and so I wanted to run through a few of those that stood out to me. The first being Man on the Moon, which is a movie that, you know, you're in one scene in it, but it's taken on sort of a new life, especially after that documentary came out about called Jim and Andy, about Jim Carrey's process of being in character as Andy Kaufman the whole time. And it's actually really interesting because the scene you're in is kind of meta as well, because it's you're an actor reacting to him doing that. But there's a lot of layers to it, and you're there with Norm Macdonald playing Michael Richards, and Caroline Ray, right, is in the scene as well.
Yes.
So, what do you remember about that experience of working on that movie, and what it was like to be there with Jim Carrey, you know, in character as Andy Kaufman?
It was not what I was expecting at all. The set was kind of terrifying because this is one of those things that you wouldn't. Unless I said it to you, unless you remember the movie, you can have a memory of the scene that we're doing within a scene that's on the TV show. Cause that was on Saturday Night Live, right?
It was on Fridays, I believe.
Oh my gosh. I just worked with Rhea Perlman, and I was trying to remember, cause she obviously is like much closer to this than I am, the source material. And I kept saying to her, I said, I think it was the show before Saturday Night Live. And she kept going, no, he was on Saturday Night Live.
Well, he was on Saturday Night Live a lot too, but yeah.
And you are so good that you did your research, or you just happened to know that. Yes, it was the show Fridays, which was a sketch show before Saturday Night Live that he was on. And so the way they filmed it was, in my mind, I just thought it was going to be the set, which was us sitting at a table. But in reality, it was on a huge soundstage. There were these huge, like, jib arm. I should know what they're called by now. Yeah. So it had like a couple hundred extras in these bleachers. And it was all for this one shot that would come in and do this huge swooping wide shot where you would see the audience, you would see behind stage, and then it would come and settle at us sitting there. Mm-hmm. But I had never been on a set that large before. And in my mind, I thought, oh, we're doing a scene within a scene. It'll feel like Mr. Show, you know, yeah. It'll feel like small and cozy. Never really talked to Jim Carrey. He was completely in character. I was not mm-hmm. around him for 1 second beyond that.
Gee, restaurants are amazing, aren't they? All these strangers just sitting around, stuffing dead animals into their faces. It's incredible.
Yeah, gee, and the bathrooms are so colorful.
Everything okay, Carl?
I'm sorry, I just can't do it. I can't play stone.
Read the cue cards.
I can't play stone. Like, I feel stupid.
You feel stupid? What about us?
It seemed to me it was more about that big move and the audience and the look of it. And Milos Forman, I never saw him. I saw him really? On the elevator. I don't even know if he knew I was the same person that was in the scene. I remember him saying to me in the elevator, I swear to God, he goes, you have nice veins. I was like,
it's a strange comment.
The fuck is going on? Like, what is that? What is this?
It's like something a vampire would say.
Yes. And I don't remember if that happened before or after. It must have been after, because I just said, I don't know if he knew I was in the scene. And so he was in some booth somewhere. And there was just walkie-talkie saying at cut and action. And it was just a massive set. And I was there for one day. And then I was in and then I was out, you know, just dreaming of Jim Carrey the day I would run into Jim Carrey again.
Yeah, maybe as himself, not in character. The other one, another one that I wanted to ask you about is Magnolia, which you write about in the book. And you were... mostly cut out of it, I believe, but you can still hear your voice on the phone in the movie. But there's this whole scene that also does exist on YouTube that people can watch.
It does?
Your makeout scene with Tom Cruise that didn't make it into the
is it online?
Into the movie. I don't think it quite gets to the kissing in the clip online, but there's a lot more of it that's than what's in the movie. So what was that like to go in and have this scene with Tom Cruise?
Unreal. Unreal. Just fantastical. So nerve-wracking, but comfortable. But, you know, like in some ways he's normal, but in other ways it's just, I mean, you can't. The guy is like an orbit, an invisible force field of superstar yeah. around him that you just get caught up in and you're like, Tom Cruise. And after, okay, so the scene in Magnolia is, what's his name? TJ Frank Mackey. Why is the TJ in there? Frank TJ Mackey. He's like a guru of selling to guys. Here's how you get women and like buy my products, buy my cassette tapes or whatever that'll teach you how to be around women. And so it's basically how to manipulate women. And he's using this example in his speech. And then it cuts to the example. And that's what mm-hmm. I'm in. And that's why I love Paul Thomas Anderson. I mean, maybe one day I'll get to work with him again. He's the absolute best. But I think that it's amazing to me that his creative vision, it didn't make it in the movie. There was already so many characters that had to be serviced. And then he's like, he's going to be speaking and we're going to go into his mind. And I'm the example of like, you go on a date, you show up, you're crying, you bring cookies, and then you know, it shows me going from being furious and wanting to break up with him to then here's how you like get in her pants, basically. And so that was the scene that we had to do over and over again. And I'm pissed and he's crying. And I watched him, the actor, cry real tears for every take, which was incredible. And then we're on the couch and he like feels me up. And so that's his example to these guys of like, job done. And, you know, follow these things. You cry, you manipulate them, you sweet talk them. And so each take, he's like feeling me up. And it was just an out of body experience.
Yeah, sounds pretty surreal.
Every time they said cut, I would jump off the couch and be like, oh my God. And then like totally professional for in the, which is just like my own, which is very true to the theme of the book too, which is I am this, but I am also this, you know, I don't know. Right. Can you believe this? I always have like the bird's eye view from the outside going like, what is this? What's happening here? You know?
And that, of course, you did work with Paul Thomas Anderson again in Punch Drunk Love. And that one playing Adam Sandler's sister. And that's a really fantastic movie as well. And you got, you know, sort of a bigger role in that didn't get cut out. So what was that one like to do with Adam Sandler?
An awesome experience. There's nothing like being on a Paul Thomas Anderson set. And I, again, having the experience of being on a lot of different sets and for a lot of different reasons when things are just maybe not done well or not run correctly, or when, what am I trying to say? When the integrity of the project is not of the utmost put first on the list, when things start going in a different direction because of money or because of lack of focus or because like not the right people in charge or not the right team in place, there's nothing like being on a Paul Thomas Anderson film where the integrity of this piece is just from the top down impeccable. And you can see it and you can feel it. You can see it and feel it in the crew members who are there for this purpose to make that piece. And it is such, you know, he's such a joy to work with for many reasons, but that was something that I noted of, it just looks different and it feels different.
How's work? Business is very food, thank you.
What's very food?
What's that?
You just said very food.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant to say very good. Maybe you said food because you're hungry. You know, when you eat. That makes sense. Is your friend here?
No. You're off the hook, Barry. You couldn't make it.
Thank you.
You nervous?
No.
You look nervous.
I feel very happy.
Oh, good. Did you get your gym membership?
Tomorrow.
Hey, I had a girl I was going to meet with Barry. She wouldn't let me do it.
You know, I've been lucky enough to work on a lot of things in a similar vein. Larry Sanders was like that. 24 was like that when I showed up there, because part of that success, I think, was because of the singular vision of the showrunners. And the network wasn't, I remember going, oh, this sort of feels like a movie. Like the producers aren't down there putting their 2 cents and trying to, they just let the creators create the thing. And it was that magical combination. But working with PTA is just like no other. And watching him kind of working on Adam to get the drama out of him, you know, and I remember having my mind blown by his, what he did in that movie, which of course the world did not want to see that at that time, yeah. You know, cut to like however many years later but at that time he was at the height of his comedic fame and goofy, and everyone's like, no, that's not, we don't want to see
him. It was a little dark for people.
Having this anxiety. Yeah. So dark. And then of course I got to do scenes with Emily Watson as well, which was just mind blowing to me. You know, I had seen her in Breaking the Waves and was just like, I can't even believe I'm in the presence of this person, let alone like, couldn't be the more down to earth, self-deprecating, like wonderful lady.
And it was Punch Drunk Love that kind of led to 24 in a way, right?
Yes. One of the producers had seen me in the, in a scene and had shown that to everybody. I didn't want to go in on the audition for 24 because I didn't, you know, I don't know how actors do it, because some days you it's just like not today. I have to self preserve. I cannot drive out to this hot place deep in the valley and read for a drama, because I knew from my experience, my limited experience reading for dramas, it was not a good combo. Me up in there, you know, CSI land, like that was not a good fit for me. I had a bad experience. I was like, no. And my agent talked me into it. And I was just hanging out in Hollywood doing weird comedy shows. I wasn't really aware of what was popular on TV. You would think I would be, because it was my business. But I remember doing like a crash course, watching a couple episodes the night before the meeting, because she was talking me into going. And he called me out on it, the creator, Joel Surno, because He's like, so do you like our show? And I'm like, yeah, it's really good. And he goes, you don't watch it, do you? Because he knew that if people knew, they would be much more like, oh my God, this is bad. And I was like, yeah, it's really good.
You weren't addicted like the rest of the country.
Exactly. So yeah, that was another, you know, I've had a few touchstone experiences during my career. And 24 was another one where their vision was so clear for whatever reason. They liked me instinctually and they went for it. Because that was another one in the room where he said, you know, there's no material, but I want to write a part for you. And I was like, okay, right. But simultaneously thinking that they wouldn't, but honestly being validated from that experience, because that's what a weird, messed up industry that is if you get some acknowledgement or some validation, even if you don't get the job, that can go a long way, you know?
Yeah. I mean, do you feel like they wanted you to inject some of your humor into the show, or do you feel like that was not really what they were looking for?
I think they did, but I don't even know how conscious they were. I think they liked the quality of me from Punch Drunk Love. And yes, that was the notion was, that would be interesting to sort of ask them what their thought process was at the time, because they ended up using it later. I think they were probably looking for what's a different element? What's a different characteristic we can have, you know? And for whatever reason, I mean, that's what's so insane. I think it was the editor, Scott Paolo. He takes credit for going, yeah, I showed him Punch Drunk Love. And like, oh, isn't this an interesting character? So it's like lifted from that and put a piece of that into 24. So certainly that speaks of you know, wanting some of that flavor. Which of course became its own thing and its own character. And then what I brought to it, because not knowing, I was scared. I knew my approach to acting wasn't going to be different, but I was scared to go in on this show that was so huge and so specific, you know, and knowing my background, knowing my personality. But I just, you know, obviously it worked out. But at the time I thought, I'm just going to try my best. What would I be like if I were this person, and try to imagine this like brilliant woman? And then the combination of them being open and then the marriage of whatever attitude, and then they could just like put more lines in there that I could get away with saying and still be believable within this show, you know? And I think they had a lot of fun with that.
Yeah. One chapter in the book that really stood out to me was the Rush Limbaugh story, which was traumatic, I'm sure. But can you briefly share what happened and sort of how you think about it now?
You're picking out all the good
all the hits.
Yeah, we got called to do this panel called 24 and America's Image in Fighting Terrorism: Fact, Fiction, or Does It Matter? That's a title. We got called to do a panel in Washington D.C. for a Republican think tank, you know, and it was given that lofty title, and you know, it was a real thing to be discussed. But really, I think it was just everyone was a huge fan of the show. Yeah. Granted, the show was getting in trouble for their depiction of torture techniques, and that was a very real thing that was happening at the time. Like, is the government taking some of these ideas from 24, or just how 24 was making it okay? The show was so wildly popular. So
yeah, it was sort of using it to justify, or in Americans' minds, maybe using it to justify what the U.S. was actually doing.
Right. And, you know, even to this day, it's like, well, no, Jack Bauer is right. He knows what he's doing. And so it's justifying this by any means behavior that is very problematic. And so Rush Limbaugh was moderating this, and he, you know, he was just being host, and there was, you know, maybe 12 of us, and he was walking behind introducing everybody. And when he introduced me, for some reason, this seems insane now, but in the moment it happened so fast. And I just equate it to like, you're at a cocktail party, you're meeting like a friend of a friend, and it's, you know, people are, oh, hey, that was this vibe. And he, which it seems insane, because like, you're at a party and you're just are like, that's what he went to, like, go kiss me on the cheek. And I was like, oh, like, we're saying hello this way. And then the kiss was on the lips.
Yeah. Which was not what you were necessarily looking for.
Not in any way.
It's pretty creepy.
Photos were taken of it. Yeah. People thought I was dating him.
People thought there was something going on between you two.
It was a moment.
That's intense.
Besides my that weird experience that I have. It speaks to the popularity of the show and how just how across different party lines we're huge fans of the show. And I think that's part of the politics that were kind of discussed in that show. And he was a fan and the producers were fans of his. And I was there.
Yeah. Do you feel uncomfortable about either, I mean, that incident, but also the politics of the show now, or how do you think about it?
I absolutely feel uncomfortable. But I also think it speaks to the world that we live in and the nature of media itself. And, you know, that's what we do. That's what we do in America. And it's for better or for worse. It's competitive. We try to do whatever. I mean, the producers always maintained we're creating an exciting show. And whether it's using hot button topics or filming stuff in a way that's like, you know, I was thinking this on the plane the other day. I was watching this Korean film and there were so many, I was like, where's the close shots? Like there were so many shots where it was just two people having, I'm like, where's the medium shot? Like, why aren't you on their face? There was just like this wide shot and they're calmly talking and the story is like plotted out very slowly. And I was just thinking about, oh, hey, where's the close up of the bullet hole? You know, where's the music? It's like, that's what we do. And I think that, you know, we tend to express ourselves in that way too. And it's time to rethink. And I don't really know how we can, because the cart's off the tracks.
Yeah. Before we get to our final segment here, the other part that I wanted to touch on, because I love it so much, is your role in It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia as Gail the Snail, which is probably one of the weirdest characters that's ever existed on TV.
What's up, suckers?
Hey, Gail.
Gail.
You look different.
I'm more confident. I've grown into my body. You're showing a lot of skin, huh?
Jealous? I'm a woman now. I'm not a virgin anymore.
Cool. Thank you.
Hey, guys. You want to come to my car and take a puff? I got some medical marijuana.
We're at your dad's funeral, Gail.
Whatevs. I'm over it. Plus, if we all showed up super high at the reception, everyone would be like, what?
Is there a story behind that? Is it just something that you auditioned for, or did you have any hand in the creation of that character, or what's the story behind that?
This is one of those things, and obviously not like 24 at all, but in terms of the behind the scenes, the part was written. It was written as Gail the Snail. They throw salt on her to make her go away. It was written hilariously. They asked me if I wanted to do it. And I can't remember at the time I had known Caitlin. We had done like this really bad sketch show together. And I actually remember Caitlin auditioning for Always Sunny because I auditioned for her part. And I remember, I remember in the room, she was so prepared and she was so clear that I thought, I was like, she's going to get this part. Mm-hmm. But so I think I'm trying to remember how I knew the guys, like I sort of knew them, maybe socially or something, or they knew of me and I knew of them. I knew of the show, obviously. Maybe it was through Caitlin and through parties or shows or something. But they, you know, they asked me to do it. So that was already a win, right? Mm-hmm. An offer. And then when I got there, I didn't want to pre-work on it because I don't really do that anyway, but I didn't want it to be a caricature, you know, like a sketch character. So I didn't want to make too many decisions. And that is typically what I do anyway. Even with something like 24, it's like, all right, you get there, you feel the tone of the set, you sort of figure out how you're going to do it. And so it was a very collaborative. And I remember going back and forth to hair and makeup. And I remember standing around with the three guys and sort of like riffing and discussing it. Like one time I came back from hair and makeup and they're like, no, that's too much. And so my instincts were correct and their instincts were correct in hiring me, because it was this like back and forth where how do you make this ridiculous character on a show? They're already depraved. And then you're asking, this person is even more disgusting than they are. How do you do that and make it believable? So it really was like this fun thing of going inside, using costume. Like we didn't want the costume to be so ridiculous, but like she is ridiculous and her costume is ridiculous. But like, you're also like, oh, I believe she exists. And just us laughing and kind of going back and forth. And, you know, having her having spit in her mouth was something that was added in this process that just made us all cry laughing during it.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that sound that you make with your mouth kind of when you're finished talking. Yeah,
back and forth, like finding this sweet spot of where that is inside of me, which is kind of scary, but where it organically is coming from. And, you know, we didn't take a ton of time, but we took the time to do it and figure it out on set and get it right. And it really like one of the most fun, like it's so fun to play.
Yeah.
She's so gross.
And you've gotten to kind of return to it over the years, over long stretches of time, which is unique as well.
Yes. And I do her on Cameo, which is hilarious.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Most of my cameos are either it's 24 or Always Sunny in Philadelphia, that's which so are funny. Very different polar opposites.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. You have two different audiences you can really reach there. So before we end, I want to do our kind of speed round type thing called the first laugh. So I just want to run through some questions about some firsts in your life and career around comedy, starting all the way back. Do you remember the first piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard as a kid growing up, or one of the first?
Whoa. This is not a good answer, but the thing that popped into my head, because it's not funny, is Whoopi Goldberg's one-person show that she did that was on HBO, where she went into all these different characters.
There's definitely comedy in it. I mean, it was serious. It was dark, but yeah.
It's a weird thing to pop into my head of like, that made me laugh. But that I remember that having like making an indelible impression on me. And I was a big Mork and Mindy fan, even though it was like not a funny show. But I remember loving Robin Williams on there.
Do you remember the first time that you knew you were funny, that you had the ability to make other people laugh?
Yeah, I definitely, when I was in art school, I was doing performance art and I always got laughs, but I just didn't know why. And all of my stuff was, I was in a performance art class, which is hilarious within itself. And while other people were doing like sculptural things or soundscapes, or mine was always performer audience oriented. If they knew I was going to do my piece, it's like, oh, well, let me sit back and enjoy. It was always, it just was this, the way that I had to come about it was like this accidental, but that's what I was doing the whole time was comedy. I just didn't realize it. I mean, I remember building like a podium out of cardboard and like trying to keep the papers on there. And that was the whole piece, was that it was falling apart. So it's just, it was just like an exercise in physical comedy that I was doing in my art class. So.
We talked about your very first time performing stand-up at that open mic and some of the bits that didn't necessarily work early on. But do you remember the first joke or bit that did really work, that really made people laugh, you know, every time you did it?
Not really, but I do remember, because a lot of my laughs came between the laughs, or a lot of my laughs came from like awkward. And it's only now that I really have like solid punchlines nowadays. It's very different. But I do remember I used to do an old Joan Rivers act, but I wouldn't tell people that I was doing it. So I would just deliver her jokes and they would get laughs. But then I would berate the audience because I would play it back and say, you didn't laugh enough. And that's on you, because I delivered it properly. So she's like, Stevie Wonder, why he's wearing a macrame plant holder on his head. And there was one about Rod Stewart and Rod Stewart's nose being so big. And I would even say like, can we talk, please? But I wasn't doing, but I was doing it in my voice, but her like jokes verbatim. And then I would play the tape on a little cassette recorder.
Of her doing it?
Yes. I played the tape and the roar of laughter, I would say, that's on you. Like if you listen to it, I said the joke right. You guys didn't laugh correctly. So there was always some project, some meta thing I was doing.
I often ask guests about memorable audition stories, and there's sort of a passing reference in your book to an audition where you were drunk. And I wanted to know, I don't think you told that story.
You are getting all the juicy bits.
What is that story? What audition did you arrive to drunk?
I do not feel good about this to this day, but I'm going to tell you because you really pay attention and you've done your research, so you deserve to know.
Oh, thanks.
It was an audition for the friend of Kathy Griffin, ended up doing this part on Suddenly Susan. Oh, the main character was Brooke Shields, and it was the friend. I was at a bar during the day with my friends and I went to the audition.
Did they know you were drunk?
I don't think so. If they did, they didn't say, but I did not get the part.
And then do you remember or do you have a story about the first time you met one of your comedy heroes?
It definitely was Janine Garofalo at that time.
Yeah.
For sure. And I was always very nervous around her, always wanted her approval. And, you know, by the time I met her, it was within the social circle that I was in. So I just was, I mean, for years, I was very nervous around her and wanted her validation. And if ever she saw my comedy set, which she did, and told me that she thought I was funny, it was just like made my life.
And finally, I like to give comedians a chance to shout out other comedians, pieces of comedy, things that are really making them laugh right now. So what's the last piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard that you could think of?
Well, I mean, good question. I really enjoy Kira Sultanovich has a bit about living on a cul-de-sac and just yelling at the kids that come into her house to try to get a snack. And she's like, who are you? And like how demanding they are. Yeah, I'm not going to be able to deliver an actual joke right now, but I'm also really enjoying, this was really recently, Lori Kilmartin was on MSNBC and she did a joke. Oh, God bless. She did a joke about that she would happily abort a baby if she had it with the Republican, if the leaker of,
of the draft opinion,
Supreme Court stuff was a Republican, she would gladly make sweet love and then have that baby aborted. And
yeah, I think I saw she turned her Twitter private after that one.
She sure did. And it's just the literal place where our culture and society is pretty scary.
It's a dark joke, but a good one.
It's a dark joke and I get it. It's very jarring to see on a news show sort of like where it doesn't belong, but she took the chance and she did it. And it just, it shows you where, kind of where we're at and people being so literal. And it shows the reactionism that is really beside the point of the legislation of it, because then everybody's just in reactive mode. And that is a component of comedy, you know, where you get a reaction out of people. If you're in a comedy club and someone says something dark or off color, but you're all in this safe space having this shared experience, that can be a great source of humor. And that is just completely lost in this type of discussion that's way overblown and shouldn't really be even talked about in the way it's being talked about, because it's such a hotbed opinion. And that's precisely the point. Mm-hmm. You get to have your opinion. You don't get to have legislation over it. It's such a like basic premise that then she's going to say that and everyone's going to, it's like, this is why your reaction to that is why it should not be, this should not even be an issue. There are bigger things that we should be working on other than this. And it's a really sad state of affairs.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I really, really enjoyed reading your book and have enjoyed your work for so long. So this was really fun for me. And thanks for doing it.
I am really, may I use the word honored that you read my book? Because that is like, that doesn't happen a lot. So this is really a pleasure for me too. So I want to thank you for taking the time.
Thank you again to Mary Lynn Rice Cubb for that great conversation. Her new memoir, Famish, My Life at the Edge of Stardom, is available now. And we'll put a link to purchase it in the description for this episode. You can find all of her upcoming stand-up tour dates at marylynnmarylynn.com/tour. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next week on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Hold up.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.